Welcome to Older Women Live. I'm Rosemary Wally. Older Women Live features women's voices from across the globe and revisits over a decade of interviews I've done with a variety of people involved in social justice issues. This series provides background to contemporary issues like age, race, gender, and the impact of globalization on women's lives. In this episode, I speak with two African women, Gertrude Habira from Zimbabwe and Helen Mashila from Uganda, both of whom are human rights advocates. Gertrude was the Secretary General of the General Agricultural Plantation Workers Union of Zimbabwe, but she was forced to flee for her life after she was issued a death warrant. Helen is a Kenyan journalist now living in northern Uganda. These women face parallel situations living in countries where opposition to the government is violently suppressed. I talked to Gertrude Habira in Winnipeg, where she now lives in exile.
Zimbabwe is situated in southern Africa. It is a landlocked country neighbored by South Africa, Zambia, Mozambique, Malawi, and Botswana, and part of Namibia. And we have the mighty Victoria Falls, the Kariba Dam, and it used to be an agro-based economy. Once upon a time, Zimbabwe was the breadbasket of Africa, but that breadbasket of Africa is no more. There have been some economic and political factors. If you are in a conflict situation and you allow the land to fail you, then that is the end of everything. Zimbabwe has been reduced to destitute. We used to survive. We used to feed our neighbors, but nowadays, no, we are having to beg from our neighboring countries because of the so-called land reform program, which was initiated in 2000 by the ZANU-PF regime. Before independence, we were colonized by the British. We got our independence after a long struggle of independence, which was bloodshed, and I would say it was really bad, and we wouldn't want to repeat that. After independence, it was lovely. We enjoyed our freedom for the first time. We could really feel it in the air that this is freedom. This is freedom. And we really had good hopes when our President Mugabe extended a reconciliation hand to the whites who had actually colonized us before and said we need to coexist and build this country together. Yes, we did journey together for a while up until early 90s when our labor movement, where I belonged, started to realize that things were going haywire within the government structures. That was the beginning of another second struggle.
What happened?
There was bad governance in terms of resources for developing the country, which were brought into the country by organizations such as IMF, the World Bank, and all those. Those resources were not channeled to develop the communities. Some of them were actually channeled into individuals. And then there was also the issue of the war vet situation, where they demanded payment for their participation in the liberation struggle when the money was no longer there. And then there was also the issue of payment of farms. We had an agreement of compensating the farms, getting the farms from the white commercial farmers and the government recycling the people. And the British government was actually compensating for that. And that compensation actually was misused as well. And now came the chaotic land reform program, whereby the white commercial farmers were actually forcibly moved from the farms they had occupied for so many years. I would say that, yes, there was some imbalances between the black and white in terms of land allocation. And that imbalance had to be actually corrected. The way it was done did not go on well with the entire citizens of Zimbabwe, because it only benefited the political elite.
The land was supposed to be divided up and shared more equally with the local population, and this took too long, didn't it?
Yes, it did take long, and the government did not address it at the right time. Yet we had organizations, the labor movement, civic society, calling for an equitable land distribution, and also my organization also was calling for land to the landless, because my organization is made of people who migrated from neighboring countries. And they migrated during the colonial era, and they had not known of any other home apart from that farm. Farm workers were actually governed by what was known as the Master and Servant Act, which gave them the right to fire and hire at the same time. So because your entire livelihood was actually attached to the farm, the employer, the white commercial farmers, would say, if you join the union, you go with the union. I don't want to see you here. Or if you stay here, I will take care of you. And thus increasing the rate of cheap labor, bondage, and exploitation. Until after we got our independence, that legislation was abolished. And then we had the Reconciliation Act, which embraced all the labor issues and other areas. And that Reconciliation Act also was repealed after some time. And where the Labor Relations Act gave more powers to trade unions to go and organize in the farms. But it was so difficult, very difficult, because farm workers have been so attached to their employer. All their working life, they've been told, this is your home. I'll take care of you. You don't have to go anywhere. Getting them into the trade union was so tough. We had to do it through persuasion. We had to do it through educational programs. We had to find so many strategies. If we don't win them today, we'll just leave them and let them digest what it means to have freedom, to enjoy your rights.
These farm workers would have depended totally on the white employers for everything.
That's correct. Everything. If you look at all the basic necessities, they were all at the farm. There was a clinic, there was a school, not a very good school though, and the teachers from those schools were not trained at all. These were teachers drawn from the field. If you would know a little bit of ABCD, you would then be promoted to a teaching position. The children will go probably from grade 1 up to 2 or 3, and then into the field, cheap labor. I remember very well when I was growing up, we used to think that we were helping the mothers, our parents in the field, yet it was a source of cheap labor. Child labor. Our parents were given large tasks in the field. And for you to be paid for that task, you have to finish it by the end of the day. An individual who didn't finish that task, he or she would have to bring his family to assist. So school was not a necessity, was not a priority, but to help the parents in the field so that at the end of the day they are paid, and then we can have bread on the table, we can have our staple food starter, and we can also probably have a little bit of clothing, not school. That was not a priority, but the priority was to get bread and butter on the table. So as I grew up looking at these things, I really felt that this was really unfair for us. We cannot go to school. We are all confined in this vicious circle where you don't know what is happening in the outside world. So as I grew up, my parents tried to give me a little bit of education, and which I did up to my grade 11, 12. And thereafter, I went back to the farms to say, oh, this is no good. Someone needs to expose these things. Someone needs to speak out for the voiceless. And that's how I started up the struggle for the farm workers.
Then you got into the union movement?
Yes, I worked for the clothing industry as a shop steward, and also decided that agriculture is the best place for me to be. From a child laborer, I rose to a shop steward, to a union organizer, to an educator, to child labor coordinator, to a gender coordinator, and finally, I got the position of a general secretary in 2000 when the road was rough in the agriculture sector.
Can you tell us about the road?
This is the chaotic road of the land reform grab. I would say, in fact, it was a do or die situation where the supporters of Mugabe regime will go at a farm, order a farmer to leave the farm there and there. They would say, we are giving you 3 hours, 2 hours, 1 hour to pack your particulars. And within an hour, you would only grab your family and leave the entire property, the entire what we have worked for so many years, and go nowhere. But what people didn't know from across the world was, yes, the farmer might leave the farm. And in Zimbabwe, farms are so big. Each employer, each farmer used to employ 50 to 200 people, 300, even 1,000. Farm work is labor intensive. And behind that one farmer, there are 200 people who are also being displaced. While the farmer was trying to make his getaway, even out of the country, to go to Australia, United Kingdom, Canada, America, there's no way he was going to take these 200 farm workers with him. They became displaced and destitute.
There was an awful lot of violence as well, wasn't there?
There was a lot of awful violence, gross human rights violations. As a trade union worker, trade unions are not there to negotiate wages only, working conditions. They look at the entire welfare of the worker. When these workers were being displaced, thrown out of land, the trade union started to document all the gross human rights violations. They started to stretch their arm to start feeding these workers, to work with other NGOs to say, this situation in which we are is not of our own making. We don't have food. Children have been pushed out of school, let alone HIV/AIDS is not sparing us. The civic society, other NGOs started to chip in to help, but that help did not go a long route because they were stopped. Food, which was meant for farm workers, clothing, was confiscated as we went to deliver that food. So it was really a tough, tough situation. People were killed, both farmers, farm workers, animals, you name it. It was really, really gross. If there's anyone who wants to see the documentary which I produced, we took it upon ourselves as a union to say, I think the world needs to know these things, that this is not an issue of black and white. It is an issue of human rights violations.
So you made a film?
We used the mobile phones to do our shootings because there was no media allowed into the farms, let alone independent media. We developed techniques to get information from the people. For you to be part of your union, you have to go to the community and be part of them. When these things were happening, we were actually in the field.
Well, I was somewhat intrigued by the idea that Gertrude Hambira, with no prior experience, had made a documentary movie using a cell phone. And what she'd done was to document the abuses of the farm workers by the police and by the local administration. And I was really intrigued by the fact that here she was in really isolated areas doing this kind of work. I was always really interested in Zimbabwe and also in Uganda, because these are two countries which are really God's own country. This is where the sun shines all the time. They've got enough rainfall, and the soil, you more or less just have to look at it and it will grow anything. And yet both the majority of people in Zimbabwe and in Uganda are very, very poor and hungry. And that's intriguing and horrifying to me.
Farming is not something you would say that this is my farm now and by tomorrow the field is green. It's a process. And that process cannot even take a year or two or three. It's a very long process. Had they wanted to be part of this process, they would have started small and then grow big and learn from the white commercial farmers. From the farmers, farm workers, they had enough experience which they had developed over the years. Experience, expertise, knowledge. Despite that, farm workers did not go to school. They knew what was crop rotation. They knew what type of fertilizer to apply on this crop. But that was all gone within a couple of days. It's so easy to destroy.
A lot of people have been displaced. What's happened to them now?
Some are still abandoned in those farms. Some of them migrated into the urban area and they just came into the city and built shacks, which were later destroyed. I can't remember the exact year, what was known as the Operation Cleanup. We used to call it our tsunami, where the government went by and just destroyed those houses and they had nowhere to go. And also some of the farm workers, they went to neighboring villages to try and buy a piece of land so that they can stay there. But others, they were just abandoned, they become displaced, and up to now they are still suffering because even those who have taken over those farms, they are not utilizing them. They are saying that you have to work for us. you made the white person rich, and now the turn is for the black person to be rich. You have to work for us.
And what's been the reaction of Canada?
In terms of developmental programs, going direct to the community, they've really done a lot, but more could have been done. I remember very well my organization. We put up a school at one of the villages because we had children walking for about 20 kilometers a day to go to the nearest school, and the girl child was actually not finishing school. Along the way, she was abused, and we got funding from the Canadian government through SIDA, and we put up a block of school. We now had these new settlers in that particular area saying, this school belongs to us. And then we had to say, no ways. This school belongs to the community. Every child has the right to go to school. And I'm glad to say that that school, regardless of the challenges, at least the children are no longer walking long distances. We had a program through the International Labour Organization called Stop Child Labour. School is the best place to work. That program, irregardless of the current challenges, is moving on slowly. We have a coalition called CACLAS, Coalition Against Child Labour. This is a coalition made of the trade union, the teachers, and some non-governmental organization. As a trade union, we identify the children who are working in the field, those children, the vulnerable, I would say the vulnerable of the vulnerable, those affected by HIV as orphans, and we withdraw them from the field and try to put them into schools. Where there's a child, there's a teacher. And in the farms have been forgotten. And we are saying, teachers, we need to work together. You cannot only work in the urban areas or in the villages which are structured, but we really need to go right in the remote areas, in the farms, and work with these children. So that's why we formed this coalition.
What's Canada doing in terms of the very well-documented human rights violations in Zimbabwe?
I will give a very good example of myself. Canada, Amnesty International, was the first one to write to the Zimbabwean government to say stop the violation of Gertrude Hambira and her constituency. And then later started flying from all over the world to stop my persecution. And even up to now, as we are talking right now, persecution of human rights defenders continue. Recently, we had Beatrice Mutetwa. And prior to that, even prior to my persecution, we had Justina Mukoko, a very prominent human rights defender who was kidnapped and kept in secrecy for 21 days. Canada stood up and said, we want Justina out right now. Then came myself, Canada stood up. Then came today, as we are talking right now, Beatrice Mutetwa, a prominent lawyer who represents human rights defenders in the country. She was also arrested, and Canada was up in arms.
What happened to you that Canada had to come to your defense?
When I was interrogated by JOC, the Joint Operations Command, I was not arrested, but I was called for interrogation by the high-ranking officials of the Army, the police, the Air Force, the Central Intelligence, and I was highly interrogated and told that I need to be thrown into prison and be tortured to death. But what I did when I went for that interrogation, I took a human rights lawyer with me, my work colleagues, and that is what saved me. Because as we walked into the interrogation room, they said, look at her, she comes here with other people. Meaning that, had I gone there on my own, we wouldn't be talking today. Knowing from past experience, those who have been called before that committee, that will be the end of their life. So after that interrogation, there was no way they were going to say, Gertrude, you stay, the rest you can go. Because already these guys, my colleagues, had already seen who was part of this structure which was interrogating me. So after about 3 hours, they let us go, and they said, we are not done with you. You need to hang around. We will call you again. So they let us go. 5 days later, they pounced on our office. I'm a woman of faith, because even when we go out into the field, we used to pray for God to be with us, to guide us, to protect us. We really pray. We fast and pray. On this particular day, when these other guys came to the office, my angel just told me, Gertrude, leave the office. go and pick up your son from school. And I said, no, I can't leave the office. I still have other things to do. And I was told, just leave this office. And I left the office. So when I left the office, my colleague said, please, can you bring us some rolls and bread? We need to drink tea when you come back. I said, no problem. I went to the convenience store to buy bread. And then as I was walking to the office, my instinct, my angel tells me, don't go to the office. I said, why? I have bread here. We need to make tea. And then my instinct says, go and pick your son from school. And then I said, I still have an hour. Then I said, okay, I'll go to school. I then went to school to pick my son. In Zimbabwe, things are so bad. When you are driving, you take your purse because you can be burglared and put it in the trunk. So that is where I put my purse and my mobile phone. And I drove to school to pick my son. And I parked my car. I waited for 30 minutes and then went to pick my son from the classroom. And I drove back. As I was approaching home to drop my son, my conscience tells me, pull off the road. I pull off the road and then my son said, why are you stopping? I said, well, I need to check on my phone. I take my phone, I look at my phone. There are more than 50 calls, all of them from the office. And then I said, oh, these guys, they are crazy. They want bread from me. And then I said, okay, let me try and call them back. So as I call them back, no one is speaking. Some of them have actually switched off their phones. And then eventually someone calls me and said, Gertrude, where are you? The office is under siege. Just leave the country right away. I started trembling, shivering, to say, now where do I go? I'm here with my son, with my handbag, my purse. That is all I have. I had to gain my strength. I had to pray. I called one office to say, this is the situation. And then the civic society was alerted. The world was alerted. And ZCTU was alerted. And they said, okay, wherever you are, just stop there. We are coming to get you. And then they came and picked me up. And then the first thing they asked me was, do you have your passport with you? Fortunately, I had spent 3 days looking for my passport in the house. And that very same morning, I said, oh, I need my passport. I might be traveling anytime soon. And I'd put it in my purse. And then they said, okay, we'll take your son. We'll take care of him. And we are now working on a route for you to leave the country because we don't want another bad situation. You just have to leave the country. And there I was, leaving the country. I went to South Africa. South Africa is not a bed of roses for immigrants. It's so tough. I was emotionally distressed for 10 months. Despite that, I continued with my advocacy. I traveled to Europe, to the International Labour Organization, to many different organizations to say, this is the situation. I went to the United Nations in South Africa to say, this is my situation. I'm under surveillance. And the UN says, we know about your situation. But you just have to go through the processes. There are lots of refugees here. And going through that process meant I was going to be in South Africa for more than 2, 3, 4, 5 years. So eventually, the guys here from the Rotary International engaged David Mitas, a human rights lawyer here, and other lawyers. They put their wisdom together and they said, if she has a United States visa, let her go to the United States. And then she can cross through the Niagara and declare refugee. And that's what I did. But at the back of my mind, I said, oh, Lord, what about these 3 children? There was a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 15-year-old.
So how did you get your children here?
I had to get them back from South Africa to Zimbabwe. They were being under the custodian of my church friends and the church. As we were working on my refugee claim here, a petition was put down to go to the immigration minister to say we need to get these children out of Zimbabwe like yesterday. And yeah, it worked on very well. After a year, a project was put by the Rotary Club, which was called Out of Africa. You can Google it, Out of Africa Rotary International. And they got the children out of Africa. The children who had never traveled abroad. One of the Rotarians volunteered to go and meet them in South Africa and bring them here. We will keep on telling the story. We need to support each other. Those who are prayerful can do that. Those who are strong advocates can do that. There are so many strategies which are non-violent so that we can strive for a peaceful world, let alone Africa.
Like Zimbabwe, Uganda is politically restless and the people are suffering. I spoke with journalist Helen Mashila about the 26-year war in her area of northern Uganda and the issues of reconstruction.
Helen Mashila is a master's student in conflict transformation studies at Gulu University in northern Uganda. She's also a journalist, a mother, a grandmother, and is an intern here at Concordia. Helen, you live in northern Uganda.
In my area, there has been a very long war, over 20 years, that was between the government of Uganda, the United People's Democratic Force of Uganda, against the Lord's Resistance Army, which was a rebel group that was formed by somebody known as Joseph Kony, who comes from northern Uganda, in Gulu district where I actually come from. And Joseph Kony did not like the government of the president Yoweri Museveni. He wanted to unseat it. He says that he wants to replace that government with one who follows the Ten Commandments. So the Lord's Resistance Army has been fighting the government all this time, or with the government all this time. But in 2006, they came up with an agreement. It's called the Cessation of Hostilities Agreement. And that allowed people to start living at least a life outside war. In other words, they could be able to go back to their homes. During this long period of war, the government had come up with a policy to shift all the people who are affected in that region to internally displacement camps, which the government argued were going to be safe places where they could be able to protect the people of northern Uganda from the Lord's Resistance Army. What the Lord's Resistance Army was doing that time is that it was abducting children and forcing them to become child soldiers or wives to those LRA rebels. So the government came up with that solution, and they thought that those IDP camps would take very short and they were going to wipe out the war very fast, but it took very long, and therefore it created a crisis. But as we talk now, after 2006, all those IDP camps have been closed down because the war has ended, as in open war where there is shooting and all this gun violence has stopped and people have gone back to their villages. What is happening right now also is that Joseph Kony had been indicted by the International Criminal Court in the year 2006, and he is hiding somewhere. Sometimes they say it is in the DRC Congo, sometimes they say in the Central African Republic, where it has been reported that he is still doing the same things he used to do in northern Uganda, abducting people and forcing children into war and forcing girls into sex slavery. Inside northern Uganda, people are living ordinary lives. There is a lot of reconstruction that is going on, and therefore roads are being constructed. There are other donors who are coming in to give money to build hospitals, to help people, but it is not easy.
Helen Mashila spent a year in Montreal as an exchange student from Gulu in the north of Uganda. And while she was here, I was lucky enough to meet her. We originally met up over a Mother's Day show on the radio. She wanted to talk about her mother, whom she greatly admired, who's a very, very strong local politician in Kenya. You know, which is very unusual for women. So Helen wanted to talk about her mother, which she did. And then we also got on to talking about where she herself lived, which was Gulu, northern Uganda, and what the issues and problems were in her region.
Even now as we talk, people are still recovering. And reports have been that a lot of people are mentally disturbed. We have a lot of suicides. We have a lot of excessive drunkenness. We have a lot of crimes such as rapes. if you follow their roots, you may find that it's because of trauma. So people are really traumatized, it is true, but also there are organizations that are trying to handle that. The government has a peace recovery and development program that involves a lot of partners in the international community, but the civil society organizations and also community-based organizations, church organizations, all of them are trying to work towards that. Also, there is a lot of other activities that are going on to help people maybe start farming and keep cattle or even learn new skills or modern ways of agriculture so that they can have enough food for themselves.
What's happening to the really vulnerable members of society, the children and the old people, pregnant women? What's their situation?
The situation of children, the elderly women, also the pregnant women is quite appalling. But of course, it's not as bad as it used to be during the war. The reality is, even after the war is over, people are still struggling. Because remember, these are people who have been in internal displacement camps all these years. The infrastructure was not growing at all. They were not having any money. Many of them had to leave their children without going to school. They were depending on the UNHCR or donations, food donations. Now they have gone back to their villages. Now when you start talking about pregnant women, they will have to walk very long distances to reach health centers, which are very poorly maintained and very few workers. So there will be very long queues during antenatal clinic. When you go to a labor ward and you'll find women on the floor who have just had babies, others who have just come in with labor pain, but they do not have cloth, they do not have even a bed or a mattress. Many of them will carry their babies with just a small piece of cloth, which is maybe they have teared from one of their clothes to carry the baby home. When they reach home, there's no one to give them any service. Water is very far. They use a lot of boreholes there. But pumping water in itself is very hard. And a lot of those children are born by girls who have been raped, maybe, or who have entered relationships against their will, and the men are not committed people. And if they are committed, they don't have enough source of income. So there is a big problem to do with the pregnancy. When we talk about grandmothers, many of them, they are having to take care of grandchildren alongside their own children sometimes. Their children may have been those who went to the war and came back with children. Maybe they found the life in the village is harsh, they cannot be able to make enough money. And the grandmother decides to keep the child so that the daughter can go somewhere in town and get some short-term employment or some petty employment like working as a maid, or maybe some of them even doing commercial sex work, which is also there, to get money. But the money they get is very little, and it is not sufficient enough to support their mothers who are taking care of their children. So the grannies are having problems. Some of those grannies have children whose mothers are not alive or whose fathers are not alive. They have to struggle without jobs, without infrastructure, living in a grass-thatched house, hardly having enough money to buy food, and still bring up a grandchild. Some of them are even sick. They were infected during the war. It's really hard for a grandmother in northern Uganda to survive. So we can talk of NGOs like the AIDS support organization, TASO, which does give support to people who have the burden of bringing up children orphaned by HIV/AIDS. There is a lot of need. Those NGOs, those CBOs, those civil society organizations which are trying to handle those situations are not being able to cope with the need on the ground. Children have to walk very long distances to go to school. Many of them cannot have even lunch. And on their way home, sometimes they get defiled because there is that problem of trauma. There are a lot of youth who are jobless and who came back from the war. You find them maybe sitting, drinking throughout the day. Recently, when I was doing my research work for my thesis, many of those centers where I visited, you would find a lot of young people who are very drunk. It is 10 a.m. in the morning. they are still displaced people in the sense that in their villages they are not fitting because they were used to free life. And maybe they don't even know where their land is because they were born in IDP camps. They are still having conflict in their villages. Now, these youth sometimes become a problem to the young girls who are running to school. And the same with the boy child. The boy child is also affected because he is a young boy running to school. He can find a rowdy boy on the road and he gets attacked. Food is not easy to find for these children when they are in school. And the government is trying to come up with food programs in schools. So it's not easy for children, for mothers, and for grandmothers in northern Uganda at this time. In northern Uganda, people perform peasant farming. And now they are trying, with the help of NGOs and government, to maybe introduce commercial farming. But it's at a very, very, very low level.
What's the traditional role there of the grandmothers? Are they respected?
If you go by the traditional society of the Acholi people, yes, grandmothers had a traditional role that had to do with being consulted during conflict and even when decisions were being made. The elders would involve the grandmothers, so they kept the family together. They were peace brokers. When children quarrel, they would go to the grandmother and the grandmother would sit with them and talk to them and they would listen. But right now, because of all these changes, it is not really a very strong practice. Yes, they are respected when it comes to the cultural values, but the culture has been interfered with the modernity that seeped in during the war. So as of now, I would say a grandmother in Acholi may not really be so proud as she would have been those days because there are all these challenges around them. First of all, things like getting children out of wedlock and leaving them to a grandmother to take care of was not a practice in the traditional system. Children would still go and visit their grandmother, but they have been released by their father and mother with all their respect. So they would go there maybe to listen to their stories, to be given the cultural values of the Acholi people. But now, I don't think they're enjoying that privilege anymore.
What do you see as the future for northern Uganda, Helen?
There is a lot of potential because, as I said, Uganda is a nation that has been in these long wars, but now we can see peace has come in. I wouldn't say there is any challenge to make the situation deteriorate because more and more people have come to accept that peace is the way to do things. Right now, as we talk, they are combining the traditional methods of reconciliation at the local level to reconcile the people between those who had gone to the war, in other words, the ex-combatants, the formerly abducted, and the communities which they had during the war or they destroyed during the war. So a lot of forgiveness using the traditional methods is going on. But economically, I would say there is a big challenge there, just as it is in Kenya, in other African countries. Our economies are not very strong. But when we look at what is happening in Uganda, there was a lot of war, now there is no war. So that tells me that there is a bright future that is coming. But it is dependent upon what is done right now with the relative peace, because there's a lot of structure to be built. There are a lot of politics. People can disagree around their political views. So it depends on how the international community gets involved in these things. And also the Ugandans themselves decide to do about the peace that is already there. But the very fact that there is a lot of good things going on makes me think that there is a brighter future.
You were just listening to episode 7 of Older Women Live, the podcast. On this episode, you heard Gertrude Hambira and Helen Mashila. Older Women Live is produced by Michelle Macklem and me, Rosemary Wally. Older Women Live is a production of Aging, Communications and Technologies and CKUT 90.3 FM, both in Montreal, Canada. You can listen to more episodes by subscribing on iTunes or visiting our website at actproject.ca/OWL.